I'm gonna start recording again.
Okay, nice. That's not our first time using this software.
Big blue button?
Yeah.
It's really nice. There's a nice paper someone wrote about their like intentions for it too, as this self-hostable software that is supposed to be particularly designed for learning, I think, for like classrooms and stuff.
Okay, nice.
But yeah, we're kind of guerrilla occupying this big blue button instance for the moment. Because I haven't talked to the people at domainpublic.net. We just noticed that they had an open instance that you could sign up for. So it's actually coming up for the class because we wanted to email them and confirm that they were okay with us using their instance for our class, which seemed like good etiquette rather than just arriving and doing some big thing on it.
It's like someone else shows up halfway through your class.
Or I don't know, like if someone just noticed you had a yard where some stuff was happening and all of a sudden they just started like teaching a 30-person class on it. You'd be like I guess you could do that there, but
yeah, it might be a breach of etiquette for sure.
So we started talking about your recent work with Peer to Panda, but then paused so that we could turn on the recording. But yeah, I would love to hear more about what's going on there and with P2P. And maybe even just to introduce the project a little bit.
So I guess hopefully I do it justice. Peter Panda is, I guess, was born out of really festival organization. I think that's what Sam and Andreas and their friends were involved in originally. They're kind of have backgrounds as musicians and quite active in, I guess, the art space. So they wanted to be able to organize festivals and sort of build software to aid in that. You know, like how do you share information relating to a festival, and how do you allow participants to communicate with one another? And I think there may be some commercial offerings for that. But eventually that led them to build Peter Panda, which is kind of like a toolkit for building decentralized applications. And they've done their best to make it really flexible at the lower levels so that the sort of shape of the data for your application can be quite dynamic. It's not sort of predefined by Peter Panda software itself. And so they've been, I think they were funded by an NLNet grant. So it was Andreas and Sam and Vincent and I think Pete and Sophistica were all involved, and maybe Alyosha a little bit as well. And now they've gotten a second NLNet grant to kind of extend the work that they've done. And part of that is networking and replication. So I was originally brought on board to write a connection manager. That was something that I'd voiced to Sam that I was interested in. We have a weekly, it's called like a P4P meeting, like peer-for-peer mumble call that we have every Monday, which is kind of like a, I guess, like a peer-to-peer coffee meeting. That it's kind of got that vibe, like sitting down with your friends to have some tea. So we chat a little bit about personal stuff, and then we share what we're working on at the moment. And Gwil from Earthstar is also a part of that. And I'd mentioned in those calls, like, oh, I want to write a connection manager, like just for the sake of learning. And then it was also going to be applicable for Solar, which is this scuttlebutt node that I've been contributing to. So that was sort of my entry to the project. And one of the cool things about the Peter Panda team is they really put a big emphasis on research and reading and planning before any code is written. So we did quite a stack of reading in terms of what our options were for the networking layer. And libP2P was coming up in those conversations. And it's kind of interesting because I think in some of the, like at least among some of the, what I'd call the scuttlebutt crowd, maybe libP2P had this, I don't know, there's some like tension about it or animosity or dislike. And I think I'm missing some context to understand quite why that is. Maybe has because of the association with protocol labs and IPFS. But the more research we did and the more folks we spoke with, we thought like, actually, this is a really good fit for what we're trying to build. Because libP2P is basically created this toolkit for the networking layer of peer-to-peer applications. They're like, okay, we realize that this is an inherently difficult thing. You have nodes with kind of different levels of connectivity. A lot of the nodes are behind NATs or firewalls. So there've been some really smart engineers working on solutions for several years, and their implementations in many languages. So we just thought like, wow, this actually meets our needs and allows us to focus on other parts of the stack and other parts of the development process, and rather than having to rewrite everything from scratch ourselves. So yeah, that's what I've been working on, like getting the transport up and running and like the connection layer done, and then starting to work on the discovery layer. So we're using like MDNS, for example, to do local peer discovery.
What was the last thing? MDNS?
MDNS, yeah. I think it's often used for like network attached devices, like printers, for example, where they can advertise a service using UDP multicast, like just broadcasting on the local network. And then other devices can listen for those broadcasts and automatically discover the services on the network.
Gotcha. So
yeah.
First, I feel like that's a great overview. For me personally, I'm curious more about Connection Manager. That's a term that I don't really know what it means. So maybe we can make it a little more concrete. Like, is it sort of like you have different devices or users that are running some type of peer-to-panda thing and you need to find each other and start communicating?
Yeah, so the Connection Manager, and I also, so there's quite a spectrum of definitions. So what I think of is like a minimal Connection Manager, it comes before the kind of peer discovery stuff. So let's say you're using TCP as the kind of transport protocol to make connections between your node and another one, or your application and another one. So you sort of have to manage the life cycle of that connection. You could imagine it going through various phases. Like, at first of all, maybe the connection is pending. You know, you're reaching out, trying to make the connection, and then it could fail, or you could have a connection established. And then when the connection's established, at one higher level, you want to be aware of like how many connections in total do we have established, because you might be dialing multiple peers at the same time. And if you had lots of peers, you may end up with hundreds or even thousands of connections open, and that might swamp the resources of your device or your computer. So that's part of the role of the Connection Manager, is saying like, okay, let's set a maximum, maybe a maximum and a minimum limit on how many established connections we can have at one time. That's the sort of very core of it. Then you can extend that functionality a bit by saying, okay, maybe we want to keep track of all the peers that we've tried to connect to. and we want to persist some state for each peer. So maybe I've tried to dial you 5 times in a row and it's failed every time. So I want to keep track of how many failed attempts have there been, when was the last attempt, that kind of a thing. So that's sort of kind of separate from discovering peers, because discovery has to do with what is your address, how do I find you, and the connection manager is almost like a level below that.
So sort of like once, or I'm getting a little bit confused about below or above. So it's like once you already know who the possible peers are, managing the connections with them.
That's right.
Gotcha. And then my next question there, probably then if the connection manager is starting and stopping these connections, are those actually end up being like calls to libp2p functions? So are you working with libp2p as a tool that the connection manager uses?
Yeah, that's right. So libp2p has, they use a concept of a swarm, which is sort of, I guess, the network abstraction. So they give you tools whereby you can create a transport. So this is where you're defining what protocol you're using to make the connections in the first place. So that could just be simple TCP, for example, or for P2Panda, we're using QUIC, which runs on top of UDP. So you could create your transport and configure a swarm, and then you start the swarm, and that emits events. So you have this kind of event-driven model, and then you can act on any of those events which occur. So let's say one of the swarm events, if you're running the MDNS network protocol, would be peer discovered, or MDNS discovery. So a peer is discovered and it triggers this event. And then you can take some action. You could match on that event and say, okay, once we discover an MDNS peer, we want to dial them. We want to try and make a connection. And then if that connection is established successfully, you can run other protocols on top of that. So that's where replication would come in, for example, of like, okay, once we have this connection established, then we can match on that event. And then we can start our replication protocol, which might be something just very straightforward, like, oh, I've got this information, what have you got? Let's trade.
Cool. I think I'm following. It's reminding me that I was reading the blog and research of Julia Evans in the past couple of days. Have you seen her research before by any chance?
Yeah, I have. Some of the zines I've taken a look at.
Yeah, those ones. And I was learning a lot about networking and the internet from reading the stuff, but sometimes it would kind of end up veering into like big tech scale level networking. And I was realizing there's a little bit of an interesting issue that like trying to figure out how much of our current tech stack works the way it does because of something inherent about networking, or does it work this way because this is how you need it to work when you have this centralized model where you like have to serve millions of users from particular nodes, and then the degree to which I was wondering how much these networking primitives and tools were going to have to be reinvented or have new people working on them for the content. Self-hosted software, peer-to-peer software, and that kind of sounds like that's a little bit what the work you're doing is in the libp2p stuff, and even I guess peer-to-panda could also be understood that way too, kind of.
Yeah, just trying to make it a bit easier. I mean, I think because of the way the network is, we have to add in all these things. If the internet were like one big local area network, then we could just pull a whole lot of this stuff out. Like, we just wouldn't need it. So like, one of the big issues that I mentioned earlier is NAT traversal. When you're behind a home router or firewall and you're not able to make these direct kind of peer-to-peer connections through the internet. So then we have to come up with all these kind of fancy techniques for getting around that. And that often involves a sort of a third peer with a publicly accessible IP address that can either act as kind of like a tunnel or a relay, or it can help with some synchronization to create a direct connection.
I'm glad you bring that up. I started talking about that a bit with Alex last time, and he actually gave me the brief intro to hole punching, but then was like, I'm not the person to talk to learn more about this. But I would be happy to talk more about it if you feel like there's more to explain, or if you know good resources to point to for like actually learning about this stuff in detail and what's out there.
I'm not sure I'm the right person either. I guess there are TUN and STUN are two, I forget what the acronyms stand for, but two protocols that are used for this. I could point to a project. I think like there's the Hole Punch or Hole Punch IO, has maybe come out of the DAT ecosystem. I think that's some of the folks who were involved with the DAT ecosystem who are working on tools to make this easier. And then I think there are some papers out there on NAT traversal. And then libpdp, there's something called AutoNAT, which is one of their protocols for detecting whether or not your node is behind a NAT. And then they have a circuit relay, which is this kind of third node which can pass along messages. And then they have something called direct connection upgrade through relay, DCUTR, which is another one of their protocols. In terms of the specifics of how it all works, I'm not well versed in that.
Well, that's still some good leads. In even just hearing that it relies on a third peer to help create a tunnel or some other way to get y'all connected, that was a help. That makes sense. But yeah, at some point I would be curious to talk with someone or read something to maybe look through in more detail at least some of the common ways that people go about that.
Yeah.
I guess it comes up for me when I've been, when we're talking about self-hosting, because we had to do port forwarding, which is basically the like one simple way that we make a local IP address accessible to the internet. But I guess it's more complicated when you're like doing it with multiple peers and continually and stuff, and not just like a server.
Yeah, I think that's why we sort of have this need for, I guess I think of it as a heterogeneous network where some peers do have kind of enhanced capabilities. Or in the context of Scuttlebutt, we had pubs, and now kind of maybe more prevalent or certainly more popular in a contemporary sense is our root servers. You know, some other node which has these additional features which can kind of bridge the gap, as it were.
That's a super interesting pattern you're observing, kind of zoomed out across different protocols, that there are these special actors in this heterogeneous network, but that, yeah, the special actors don't need to have all the powers of the corporate centralized server model. They can maybe do have lesser powers.
Yeah, they could have a subset, or what we're trying right now, we'll see how it works out with AquaDoggo, which is the sort of the node of Peter Panda, is to have switches for all these capabilities so that actually you're running the same node, you're running the same software, but with some configuration switches, you can say, okay, I would like this to run as like a rendezvous server or like a relay server. so that we still have one piece of software which can adapt and be kind of plastic to meet the needs.
Totally.
Sorry, I'm just
Makes
going to
sense.
close this door quickly. I guess there's some cutting of grass going on, and it's a bit noisy. I'll be right
Okay,
back.
yeah, no worries.
Alrighty, I'm back.
So I want to ask if there's more that you want to say about what's going on with PeerToPanda, or potentially we could switch to talking about Scuttlebutt a little bit.
Yeah, I think I'm good on Peter Panda for now. I would maybe, and it's, I guess I was trying to kind of subtly or not so subtly communicate this by mentioning the P4P Mumble group, but that's part of the really interesting thing for me of like how I got involved in the work, of like getting to know people over years on Scuttlebutt, and then being like, oh, like actually a bunch of us are working on projects with overlapping interests, even if we have slightly different goals, we should really be talking to one another more often. And then through that kind of community that arose from that was how I had the opportunity to work on PeerToPanda. So it's just kind of like, yeah, it's speaking about patterns, like applying these same of things to one's social life as well, and like bridging gaps between networks and different groups, and seeing the opportunities that come from like developing that trust. I think,
Totally.
yeah, been really about that.
Thank you for bringing up the social dimension of the open source and peer-to-peer world. I think of you as someone who is a really inspiring network weaver in terms of the way you've actively cultivated and maintained connections with within projects, within Scuttlebutt alike, but also between protocols. And it's cool that that is panning out with concrete effects for you, like this work with PeerToPanda. And also, like, yeah, going back to the way we met, the whatever your the spell you cast by creating the solarpunk.network Scuttlebutt pub, I think was how we originally connected on Scuttlebutt.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I guess it is. I kind of think of, so I listened to a lot of Terence McKenna recordings in my university years, like a lot. And one of the things that Terence was famous for saying was find the others. And when I heard that, I was in a I was like particularly interested in consciousness and psychedelics, and I didn't know many people who were interested in those things. So the internet gave me a way of reaching out and connecting and being part of forums and that kind of thing. And I can sort of apply the same thing to those of us who are interested in peer-to-peer and decentralized socio-technologies. Oftentimes we are the only ones in our like physical vicinity. And so it's a case of like reaching out, trying to find those with similar interests, and then trying to take it a step further, because it can be slightly lonely and isolated work. So trying to just lean on my sense of empathy and what others must be feeling, and yeah, trying to create opportunities to work together and to share and yeah, just travel together.
For some reason, when I think of this topic, I sometimes feel exhausted, but I haven't fully analyzed why. But there's almost this feeling of I would love to help weave multiple networks together. And I know that sometimes I do that just through existing in the world and my interests, but I also I It reminds me of when I was younger and I used to feel like I wanted to read all the books in the world, and like sometimes I would like freak myself out that was never going to happen. And then I sometimes, for some reason, feel like the active maintenance of networks is like daunting to me.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. And yeah, I guess it sort of comes and goes. Hey, like there are times where maybe you are quite inspired by that and you have the capacity and energy and the timing is right, and other times where it is daunting and a bit exhausting. I tend to think the sort of thing I have in my mind, and I think it's something you're seeing, or that you've seen through your travels and your experiences. It's something certainly that Luandro has spoken about, and Eric, is the power of doing this kind of work in shared physical space. So, like having a farm or a village or a place where people are doing this work on a continuous basis, even if it's just one or two people. And then there are kind of waves of other people who come to join in and practice and learn together. I really think that's kind of going to lead to a flourishing peer-to-peer future. Yeah, I mean, we're all trying to build like local first software, and that can be most powerful when it's kind of homegrown and meeting local needs, like right in the context.
Totally. And yeah, I guess I've also felt, yeah, once you get this chance to meet and be in person, even for some short period of time, it then makes the network richer in its online form, often too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and I feel you about having different energy at times too for this type of network weaving or cultivation. And it also reminds me that when, I guess ever since I left Instagram, I mean, I haven't deleted my account, but I don't use it so much. I noticed I don't manage to maintain connections with certain folks, and but through Scuttlebutt and the Fediverse, there have been some digital connections that have stayed. So I also do see the power of these networks for kind of like passively keeping connection alive. Because like, yeah, maybe even if it's great if you have the energy to organize in-person meetings or like this Mumble call where you're really actively consciously getting people together, that's obviously like a really powerful way of keeping things alive. But when you don't have that energy and you're kind of more passively just like posting, that still can keep things alive. Or sometimes, yeah, you just see someone who you haven't thought about in a while post something and you're like, oh yeah, that person, and you still feel like you're connected in some way.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think at least in your kind of question prompts in the document you drew up, you spoke a little bit about like biomimicry and observing like non-human beings and processes, and then applying those observations to one's life and one's work. And I think this quality of ebb and flow, or like pulses and waves, is something that I see in the world around me. Like there's nothing there, there are no sort of constant outputs. And I think in contemporary times, and maybe it's a product of like capitalism and many parts of the world now having like always on internet, always on electricity, it kind of creates this sort of pressure, and it can be a little bit more difficult to time one's actions in a way that's sort of balanced and healthy, because the capacity to connect is always there, right? Even if it's like making a post or liking someone's post. So it's a bit, I think of it as quite unnatural, and I think it throws us out of out of balance in a lot of ways. So I
Oh, that's
find
really beautiful.
like now in South Africa, well, for at least a decade, we've had power cuts. And so on a daily basis where we have in daylight hours anywhere between 2 and 4 hours of no electricity. And that actually helps me be more balanced, because it's like, okay, it's 2 p.m., power's going out. What am I going to do? Like, I could read, or I could wash dishes, or I could go for a walk. It sort of breaks that unnatural cycle.
Yeah, I wonder how we can connect more with healthy timing. I actually wanted to go back to you because I missed one word you said, you said pulses and waves, and then before that, was there another metaphor you used or observed?
I think I said ebb and flow.
Ebbs and flows. That was the words. Ebb and flow. Totally. Yeah, because you're right. That does seem like very much how all of nature works. From the seasons, the day, to life cycle evolution. And it's pretty funny that, yeah, with 24/7 stuff, we can get disconnected from that and get into sort of weird relationships with time.
Yeah, totally. It's like the standardization of time. I guess maybe it's like a Cartesian thing of wanting to measure and divide everything neatly, and then an hour is sort of standardized. It's like an hour is an hour. So then 9 to 5, Monday to Friday is kind of easy to impose. And yeah, so that's why I think like gardening, long bike rides, anything where you're sort of outside of that form of time, and you can observe, like I said, like non-human processes and beings, and just see what they're doing, and then you can learn from that. And I know in Taoist philosophy, timing is a big is quite a like important point. Like sometimes timing is of primary importance and action is a secondary thing. Then it's a case of like cultivating some kind of intuition for timing and when is the appropriate time. Because then the activation energy is that much lower. I kind of think of it like, I don't know, if you're a surfer trying to catch a wave, if the wave is, the swell is 100 meters away and you start frantically paddling, you're going to run out of energy by the time it actually reaches you. And so by initiating your paddle at just the right time, you can catch the wave with the smallest amount of energy. And then it, from a third party perspective, it looks effortless. And that can be applied throughout life.
Yeah, this is making me think about my initial reaction to how to cultivate timing is just to sensitize the perception and to be in a place where we can notice things. Your tips of gardening or getting out, but then yeah, for my own journey, I was thinking about sobriety and other ways to just try to become more aware of what's happening so that when you do have to do some swimming, hopefully you can do it at the right moment.
yeah, totally. And I guess not like part of that is guilt as well. Because this was something that I was thinking about a lot in years gone by, like after my travels in South America, and then when I was basically working for myself and I didn't have any external time constraints, then it's like, gee, how do I organize my time? And there was this part of my mind that was highly critical, and I would feel guilty about like, it's 10 a.m. on a Tuesday and I'm not working. Like I should be working, you know, I should be doing X, Y, Z. And then again, observing the creatures around me, I was like, well, when the cheetah is like taking a nap under the tree, I don't think it's berating itself for not hunting. You know, it's not like, gee, I'm a terrible cheetah, I'm just laying around I should be trying to catch some dinner, but I'm not. I'm the worst. I don't think that happens somehow.
Also makes me think of a chipmunk I was watching the other day that was just like going up and down some tree. This was kind of the reverse issue, but I was like, what are you doing? Like you just keep like what are you looking for? You're so active. But I assume he she had some good reason for going up and down the street so frequently. Maybe
Yeah,
not.
man, it's just felt good.
Yeah. He just needed to move around a bit. Yeah, could be.
Yeah.
Well, that's a cool topic. I'm looking back at the notes now to see. It's good that we took a winding journey through it so that we could get to some good stuff, even if we don't get to everything. Yeah. Yeah, timing is interesting with planning software projects too. I was thinking about this with our work on Peach Cloud, but like figuring out when is the right time to build on top of something, or the timing of all the different scuttlebutt components working together or not working together. It's
Absolutely.
another time.
Yeah, that's a yeah, totally. It's an interesting lens to look at it with. And again, this kind of activation energy thing of like, okay, well, if all the components are available, then you can build something quite quickly and without having to put too much energy in. But if you're trying to build something when those other pieces are not ready, then yeah, you can end up expending a lot of that extra energy. It's difficult. Like I think, especially because if you are creative in some capacity, or like you have some like visionary, like something visionary in you, then sometimes you might enjoy that thrill of being on the edge, being like a front runner or something. And you're trying to sort of explore this possibility space that maybe is relatively, it's just not mapped out. You've got to go and check it out for yourself. And sometimes you can bring something back for the group from your adventures and say like, okay, we learned something. We have something to share. Sometimes you're able to build something that really works, and other times it might be relatively fruitful in terms of fulfilling your mission, but you gain other things in the process.
Totally. And like you said about this, even getting into other protocols, I feel like when you're exploring that unknown territory and you're meeting the others who are also exploring that unknown territory, there's like something that's happening that goes beyond any fruits of one particular project or mission.
That's it, totally. Yeah, so if you're able to take that holistic perspective, which I mean for me it's not always easy, like but then there really are no failures in a sense. If you're like prioritizing community and sharing and fun and just the joy of discovery and creation, then if the product you were trying to build fails, like it's just one more learning experience. I think if I were approaching software as a kind of venture capital funded startup, and we were like, we just need to build this product and grow this thing as quickly as possible so we can be acquired and then we'll put our feet up. If that failed, it would be crushing, right? Like because it would be like, well, geez, we didn't get our goal and like we didn't have much fun and we didn't meet these other basic, like, nice things about existing on this planet.
Yeah, if you throw all those nice things out at the start and you're only waiting for your payout, that's a pretty rough starting point. Actually, still would love to hear an update on the state of Scuttlebutt, in part because I'm currently locked out of my account. I switched laptops from my Mac to this ThinkPad I got from the Libre Tech Shop running Linux, and I haven't been able to install Patchwork yet so far. Or actually, I did install it, but then when I tried to reseed my account in the method that I thought worked from doing it in the past, so far it hasn't worked. My posts have not come back. So
Ah,
I still
shoot.
might be able to figure it out at some point, but I haven't tried to reseed an account using Manyverse before, so I don't even know where exactly I put my secret key. And so yeah, for now I'm locked out.
Sorry to hear that. Yeah, many of us might be worth a try because I know they've done a lot of work on like the sort of UX of migration. They've tried to make it as easy as possible to do that, so maybe that's worth a try. But yeah, get in touch
Absolutely.
with
I guess
me.
I just
Subscribe.
wasn't I wasn't sure I wasn't sure about that though, because I know they were migrating, already had Patchwork running, but I wasn't, I mean, I guess I should look, but like I didn't copy over all my posts. I just have my secret key and my like gossip.json file or something that lists peers to potentially connect with.
Gotcha. Yeah, that should have been enough, but I don't know. Yeah, Scuttlebutt's in an interesting phase right now. I don't know if you saw, well, basically Andre Staltz, who leads the Manyverse project, for a while now he's seen the writing on the wall in terms of kind of like the, I guess what you could call the sustainability problem of Scuttlebutt, where because of the nature of append-only logs, the logs just get bigger and bigger. So especially for those of us who've been around for a few years and are quite active, it's a lot of messages, and that means it takes up a quite a lot of storage space, I think, is the primary limitation for particularly mobile devices. So the Meta Feeds work that was done a couple of years ago now was trying to come up with some solutions for like that problem. I think Andre felt quite a big personal responsibility for this kind of danger that was looming around the corner and finding some way to solve it. So essentially what's being discussed now is SSB2, or kind of deciding on a different protocol that would still utilize some of the same aspects of the existing protocol. So probably like the secret handshake would still be used, probably MUX RPC would still be used, but there would be a different log format that would be put to work. So that would allow, for example, deletion of posts, and also sparse replication, so that you could say, actually, I only want the latest messages from a peer. Or you might decide that there is a hard limit on the size of the log, and so that you could automatically prune old messages. So this is all undergoing active discussion and exploration right now. And there are some contrasting opinions about what direction we should go in. There are those who say actually preserving the messages that we currently have is really important for continuity, and therefore any new protocol should still have the ability to read those old message types. And others are saying, well, actually, we've got this really cool fresh opportunity. The momentum is carried in the community itself and not the technology. Let's really use this opportunity to make some breaking changes that are going to help the network to grow, help more developers to get involved. So yeah, it's a very interesting time in Scuttlebutt land.
Nice. Yeah, I guess with such a big shift potentially happening too, a lot of other things might be sort of paused until that direction is clarified.
Yeah, that's it. I think everyone's sort of waiting to see what happens. That's kind of an exciting time in general because There's quite a plethora of peer-to-peer projects now. I mean, EarthStar is quite advanced. There's Pizza Panda, Scuttlebutt, Quagga is another one. There's just a seemingly explosion of peer-to-peer projects, and many of them have been inspired or informed by Scuttlebutt. So that's really cool to see.
Yeah, I mean, Nostra is having a sort of moment as well. I didn't know the other one, Qua something? What was it called?
Quagga.
Quagga.
Quagga. Yeah, Quagga was like a zebra-like creature, lived in parts of, I think, mostly sub-Saharan Africa. So that is by Ditby, DTBY is the handle of the creator of that. I don't know too much about it, but I know it's written in Elixir and it uses Bamboo as the like entry format for the log. And Bamboo is also used by Pitu Panda.
Wait, I had another question, but then I just blanked. Oh, I was curious. In the light of that, I wonder what's happening with Planetary. Because I know that, like, if they're.
Yes, the latest I've heard is that they are essentially pivoting to Nostr. I think they got quite excited about Nostr, and there's obviously quite a lot of hype around Nostr. And so I think as an experiment, they were like, okay, could we take Planetary, the sort of like user interface that they have, and could we wire in Nostr on the back end? And I think from what I've read, they found it quite easy to build something, like to build a prototype very quickly. And so they are exploring that. I mean, I don't, yeah, it's not really my place to comment on it, but I guess at the end of the day, the Planetary is a, they're backed by venture capital. So in some sense, they have to go. They've got to get funding to keep their operation going. And I think that this the fact that there's so much hype around Nostr and probably a lot of money being thrown at it, then it makes sense. And I think potentially there's also some frustration there about the difficulty of working on Scuttlebutt. Certainly they've done some amazing work, like with ScuttleGo. I think ScuttleGo is now in their latest version of the Planetary app for the Scuttlebutt one is using ScuttleGo, and they've seen massive improvements in performance. So yeah, hats off to them for doing some really good work, but I think it has been an uphill battle at times due to some of the ways that Scuttlebutt is designed.
I spoke with someone else who was not at liberty to share the full details of their project, but was kind of debating whether to use Scuttlebutt or Nostra, and ended up trying to use Nostra for some prototypes they were doing. And they had some interesting feedback. It was not all positive or all negative. But yeah, I'm curious to see how these different protocols pan out. And yeah, some of the critical feedback they had of Nostra was like stuff that makes sense when you remove the eventual consistency, which is I guess what I understand. That like that is like an annoying feature of Scuttlebutt that is also helpful for some things. Yeah, I feel like this particular, thanks for the update. I feel like this particular segment is maybe like SSB insider land might not be super interesting to some folks. I mean, I don't know what people are interested in. Maybe some people will be interested in this. But I might move, maybe I'll move sections around in the interview. I could like put that towards the end or something.
Cool.
But
Yeah, what is
do you
the
still?
presentation format? Is it in text, like a transcript or audio? Or
Yeah, right now I'm leaning towards transcript and then with the audio next to it, but maybe like transcript being the sort of expected way that people would look at it. And they could
Cool.
just put on the audio if they want some background ASMR for cooking or whatever they're doing.
Okay, great.
But that was me. So yeah, I wanted to mention too, so for the transcript, you should also feel we can like edit stuff, or like you were saying, oh, if you weren't sure if you described Pure to Panda the exact way, or if there's something that comes up that you want to modify, we could always change something too.
Okay, cool.
You still have a little energy? I was thinking it would be cool to talk about microfiltration because I'd love to hear about that. And I also thought maybe, yeah, it's a cool question prompt to like mention other solidarity infrastructure projects too. Those were two ones I was thinking about.
Yeah, no, that's good. I've got energy. It's the morning for me, so I'm feeling good.
Nice. Yeah. So would you want to talk a little bit about what's going on with the microfiltrations?
Yeah, so it hasn't really got past the kind of planning phase, but essentially right now I live in, I guess it's called an eco village, but it is. A friend of mine who lives here says it's really more akin to an eco estate in terms of there's not a kind of community body that decides on who can buy in or not. There's no like community vetting process. It's more like willing buyer, willing seller in terms of the properties that are here in the village. But there is certainly a kind of more of a trend towards like living harmoniously with the surroundings, trying to leave a light impact. There's a lot of rainwater harvesting. There's some like solar for electricity generation, these kinds of things. And one of my neighbors is, I think he has an engineering background, and he is putting together kind of like a wetland, artificial like wetland installation for grey water filtering. And he's been doing the research on the plants of like, okay, which plants can we use to clean the water? And I think he'd read a little bit about using mycelium for this purpose and integrating it into a grey water filtration system. And that's something I'm quite interested in. So yeah, I've sort of looked at the site and what he's working with. I think there's a bit of a pause while he works on other aspects of his property. And then we would likely, because we're in quite a forested area, there's no lack of biomass. There's sort of any kind of tree trimming that goes on, which goes on frequently, that generates a lot of material, which can then be chipped. So we have a lot of wood chips. And so there's a species, Strepharia rugosa annulata, which is commonly known as King Strepharia or wine cap, which is particularly capable in as a filtration mechanism because the mycelium exudes antimicrobial compounds. Which are able to control the population, for example, of E. coli. So you could inoculate wood chips and have this wood chip bed, myceliated wood chip bed, which the water flows through. And in the process of flowing through that water, it is kind of cleaned in a sense that makes it healthier to flow out into the ecosystem or into the ground or towards a stream.
When we talk about gray water filtration, does that so that means the water that's not drinking water that's come after we've used it from like showering or other things. And when you're trying to filter it, is it to be drinkable again or just to return to the land?
Yeah, in this case, it's just to return to the land, and your characterization is accurate. So, dishwashing water, shower water, Yeah, those are the main things, I guess. Maybe from the laundry, clothes washing, water. So yeah, then it's just a case of cleaning and filtering that water before it goes back to the land. I think, I mean, you could do a maybe if we were in an arid area and we were trying to recapture and cycle as much of our water as possible, then you could filter that gray water to with aim of having it be drinkable again at the end. But that would those that objective would influence your design choices. You'd have to do some extra steps, I think, to ensure that it was safe for drinking.
And so you're more worried at a site survey stage and not at a stage of inoculating wood chips to actually.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Just kind of, yeah, just observing the site, seeing what's going on, doing a little bit of research into best practices. And then the next steps would be contacting a local mycology supplier, and seeing first of all if they could cultivate the species we want on sawdust, and then using that sawdust spawn to inoculate locally sourced wood chips, probably in like big plastic totes, like big containers at first, just to have a contained environment for the mycelium to become acquainted with the types of wood that make up the wood chips here, and to expand that mycelium from the sawdust onto a larger amount of biomass, and then to inoculate the wood chip bed with that.
Cool. Well, I'm curious to hear in some time where it goes next.
Yeah, I think it's probably the next on my list. Like, we're about to do a small oyster mushroom workshop, just kind of doing the classic cardboard and used coffee grounds thing. So I'm hoping that'll be a nice springboard for kind of like amplifying the interest which already exists in this place of and passing on some knowledge and skills so that hopefully when I leave here there can be a continuation of cultivation efforts.
Nice. How many people are around in this eco estate?
Yeah, good question. So if I think of like households, there's probably 20 or 30 households, I would say. And there are quite a few families with young children. So there's like a learning center that's been established nearby, and there's probably a dozen children there. So yeah, maybe about 30 people, maybe a bit more. Yeah.
Cool. That sounds like an interesting. Model and size of group of people to come together enough to be full of, have some unknowns to it, some town-like feelings, but not so much to be anonymous.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's kind of a place where a lot of the people who've moved here have moved from Cape Town, and some of like the outlying areas of Cape Town. So they've sort of undergone this journey from like the center of sort of busy city or suburban life to kind of more of like the quieter suburbs. And then they make the big jump out here, which is like more of like a I don't know, semi-rural place. There's some cool stuff like just communal buying groups, for example. Like, okay, someone says, I'm going to do a big food order. Is anyone else interested? And I think those kind of slightly low stakes communal efforts are a nice stepping stone, like to build trust and practice working together. And that could lead to, I hope it would lead to bigger communal projects where there is more cultivation and emphasis on the commons and trying to break out of this kind of like privatized model of being.
Some co-buying as some initial experiments for like food or stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
This is my random thought from my travels and spending time in rural areas. I guess before I was imagining rural and urban ways of life as more separate. And for some reason, I've been having this perception recently that they're not really separate. They're like so entangled because mostly the rural areas are providing food to the cities, but also urban industry is often providing like phones and other forms of knowledge that go back to rural areas. And they just feel like, just more connected to me than they did in the past. And it also was making, so it's cool too hearing about like this pathway of a group of people from a city going to the suburbs and then to somewhere rural. And I'm more interested in this type of journey too. I guess also this thought I'm sharing comes from meeting some folks in more conservative rural areas, where there's like among young people some like really genuine desire to go to cities and learn the world, or like, I don't know, even like people where men aren't allowed to have independence, or like certainly not queer people, and that there could be some kind of like cycle and return of like a movement of people wanting to go to the cities to like meet other people and learn new things, but also maybe not wanting to stay there.
Yeah, I think humans have always moved, and certainly there's these flows of goods and people that kind of link these areas. I think in the South African context, there's a massive draw. Like the city holds a powerful draw, and it's often around employment opportunities, education opportunities, which is, I think, quite common in a lot of parts of the world. But the city tends to have this kind of magnetism, and if you are coming from a background of limited means, especially like limited financial resources, you can get stuck in the city. I've like met some people and heard some heartbreaking stories of people just really wanting to go back to their home village and be with their mom and their friends and family, but they're kind of stuck in this.
They stuck because they get a job in the city, but then they don't have the mobility to leave that job. Is that where it comes from?
Yeah, or even sometimes not having a job and being stuck in the city, basically being stuck in poverty. Being a long way from home without the financial resources, without like stability of a set income. And then it's like, okay, well, my village is on the other side of the country, or my village is several countries away, and just not having the means to make that journey. And there's also often the pressure of, if you are the one who's leaving the rural area to go to the city, there are a lot of expectations on you. It's like an excitement. You're like, oh, you're going to the city, you're going to get a good job, like you're going to be making money, you're going to send some of that money back to us and help us. And if that works out, then it's awesome. And if it doesn't, then I think it's just a lot of pressure.
Totally. Yeah. That thing about getting stuck resonates with me too, for certain, some people I've met too, where they seem like they're almost living in a circumstance that no one would have chosen. Like, I guess I'm thinking about things I've been seeing in Indian cities where it's like really, I don't know, just kind of like a random spot. It feels like that a bunch of people are living next to each other. But I guess that's what happens by circumstance, or when plans change along the way. Like, you know, and then there's this interesting like feeling of a second generation too, where at some point that becomes home, even though it seems like it's like not where one would have planned to have start of a life or something.
Yeah,
I guess in particular in Bangalore, there's like there's the metro, and then there's like a whole beyond the metro, there's like another hour of driving there where there's still just so many people living. Like it's just like such an endless unplanned city. So it just seems like so much was unplanned and just happened by some kind of circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I think I'm getting a little tired, so easily falling into rambling. I would still be really curious if you wanted to just maybe mention some references of other projects that inspire you, or when we're talking about solidarity infrastructure, either in person or the type of community stuff you're seeing that you're dreaming of for the eco estate, or through the digital stuff, just like other stuff you've been keeping an eye on or experience that comes to mind.
Yeah, I was thinking about this a little bit. Strangely, I don't have like a really long list. I think there is Co-op Cloud, like involving Decentralize and Kawaii Punk and Adil. So that's cool to see like a cooperative, you know, doing good work and trying to build things on a different model, like still run a business in, with a different model where it's like non-hierarchical, and there's like solidarity amongst the workers. And what else? Inspiring projects. I mean, it's a lot of the community networking project and community mesh networking projects. So some of the work that Luandro is involved in Brazil, you know, some of the kind of wider efforts that digital democracy are involved in, like the Earth Defenders Toolkit, the Mapio project. What else? Yeah, I know CBLGH, who you just interviewed the other day, came up with a nice idea for a mutual aid experiment amongst members of Mervais, the Mervais Mastodon instance or Fediverse instance. So that hasn't quite gotten off the ground yet, but I'm interested to see how that works out. The idea there was like, okay, we already have a open collective for the instance. What if we received contributions to that open collective? And during the course, we run the experiment for 3 months, and any member of Mervais can say, I would like to participate as a recipient. And then at the end of the month, the total amount of donations would be divided equally between all those who said they'd like to participate as recipients, and they receive that money. So it's just really straightforward. And I think it came out of the observation that many of the members of Mervais, the sort of creative people, maybe they have a music project or an art project, and they might have a Patreon account or a coffee account or something like that, where they are, you know, trying to receive support for their work. And CBLGH was like, well, maybe we could utilize our kind of community reach to receive contributions for the collective. So I'm quite interested in like simple experiments like that, just to almost create like a safe space to practice, shared earning, like different models of income. I know some years ago, I don't know if it's still active, and I guess I won't name them, but there were some friends of mine that I met through Scuttlebutt who had a kind of shared income system, where I think there were maybe 4 or 5 of them, where every month they would put their income into a pile, into like a joint account, and then draw draw a salary off that. So especially for freelancers, if you have a variable income, you're going to have some good months and some bad months. And this was an attempt to try flatten that out and add a bit more security of like knowledge of what would be coming in. What else?
Are you personally interested in participating in some of these shared schemes, or you're kind of, I mean, you're kind of like an, also in this like open source freelancer route right now, it seems like just developing a network and finding different projects. Or do you have any dreams of changing how you work in some way?
No, I'm really happy. I'd love to keep doing this. I've been very, very fortunate to be funded to work on open source peer-to-peer stuff for the last few years. So I guess part of my personal strategy and approach is to continue building relationships and friendships amongst those who are working in this kind of direction. And I'm really happy that this year I'm contributing to Peter Panda. I'm going to be contributing to Cabal. And I'm doing some Scuttlebutt stuff. So that feels really good in terms of just having a little bit more resilience. But I would like to take that next step and do some kind of collective finance management sort of thing. I think in some sense, the relationships that I've been developing over these years and the work that I've been doing is building towards that, because I think it's something that requires a lot of trust. But certainly it's also something that human people have been doing for a long, long time. There's all kinds of places around the world where there are like collective savings pools and different kinds of like community finance structures. So I think that would help, because that is the tricky thing with freelancing is having that security. Or I've also heard it spoken about in terms of, especially if you're getting a lot of your income from grants, maybe you're like halfway through a grant project and you're already having to think about grant applications for the future.
This was a topic on Alex's mind as well, and we talked about it a bit.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I think Alex has thought quite a lot about this kind of thing and has some really good ideas.
It's reminding me of when I was doing freelancing for like VC-backed startups and random tech companies, and my journey was from being an individual freelancer, like getting my first job on Upwork.com, this gig economy thing, to then like banding up with other freelancers to start a consultancy, and how that gave me a lot more sense of security at that time in my life. And also, we were able to like charge way more and be more well known and receive more possibilities. But then that also, I mean, it didn't fit me at that time and wouldn't fit me now, because I don't want to do freelance work for companies particularly, if they don't have any special thing going for them. But it's cool to hear, to imagine more like decentralized or open source focused groups, like whether it's Autonomic or Peer to Panda. There's some possibility for people to also come together with a focus that's like closer to our interests. And I feel you too, that it doesn't, the work you're doing already is maybe creating the groundwork that could blossom into that later.
I think, I mean, I guess quite a few of us who work on peer-to-peer open source stuff, we're already used to having, well, put it this way, we don't lead extravagant lives. Like we're not driving fancy cars and living in expensive apartments and that kind of thing. Like we're, I think, generally fairly simple people in terms of our material needs and expenditure. So we're already used to living quite cheaply, but just that level of stability and security that comes with knowing, like, okay, at the end of this month, I'm going to receive X amount, and for the next 12 months, that, you know, that's going to be what's happening, just to even things out a bit. But yeah, well, see what the future holds.
I'm going to share my experience based on my bike journey, was to do some type of open source collaborating or programming school while on a bike trip. I thought you might be interested by that idea too. There's like,
that sounds right.
Different possible variations of it, but what I noticed with biking is people are support to take you in on the in part because you're mobile, so you won't stay around forever. But also, I think because something about biking, they just like, you're putting in the effort, like you deserve a break.
Yeah, people want to feed you and care for you.
Yeah. So, I was thinking it would be cool to, I don't know, go on some multi-month version. I mean, like I said, there's many different versions of it, but where you would bring like solar panel and that's it, or the stuff you need to do some work along the way. And then mostly just like living very simply, you know, you can very much have pretty low expenses while you're living on a bicycle, but then also finding people along the way to take you in for longer periods of time so you could like sit and get some work done.
I remember there's someone who'd done something similar. I think lots of people, but there's one person I remember who had done a similar thing, but with photography. So I think they were like teaching people about photography as they traveled, but then also just like taking people's photos. You know, they were visiting a lot of like rural places where maybe a lot of those folks had like never had their photo taken and didn't have a nice printout photo that they could keep. So yeah, there's some cool different possibilities there.
Yeah, if you want to point, if you have a link to that or something, I'd be curious. I'm still just in the brainstorming phase here, but this was a trip where I was able to do a fair amount of work on the road, and there've been a few places I stopped where I was like, wow, if I could just have some proper power out here, like, I could probably stay out here a long time. And yeah, and I guess this would also meet a need of mine from traveling, which is to do something more collective. Because I like being on my own, but it would be nice to have some type of shared container as well.
Yeah. Nice.
Well, I think this is good. Won't go on forever and ever. I guess maybe this small question, if there's any books, YouTube videos, or references that you would want to share, you can add those to the list.
Books, YouTube, references.
It's okay if not too, but...
I might have to come back to you on that one. Let me just make a note of that. Books, maybe podcasts, videos. Yeah, I sometimes feel like, especially about technology stuff, I wouldn't call myself a fraud, but like, I feel like I know so little, and many of my, I guess, inspirations come from other places, but let me think about this.
Outside of technology, that's fine too. The inspirations could also not be directly related to technology.
Cool. Well, then in that case, I'd say read more mycology papers. You know, like really, really dig deep into, like, get outside of the human realm and learn about those things, and then try apply them to the human work you do.
Can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for taking it. I might end the recording. That seems like a good note to end on.
Cool. Thank you very much.